This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. We hope you'll stay tuned. But I am very, very pleased to have with us Dr. Jonathan King, professor of molecular biology at MIT and also on the board of directors of the Council of Responsible Genetics. Dr. King, you're with us to talk about genetics and ethics today, and certainly I know you have a tremendous amount of experience. Can we begin by talking a little bit about where we stand with genetic research today and how we've gotten there, and also how that has impacted our entire kind of healthcare system?
Sure. Let me do a quick few paragraphs of Genetics 101. Right, all organisms naturally breed true, right? Ducks give birth to ducks and humans to humans and barley plants to barley plants. And the instructions that are carried down through the generations are written in the nucleic acids and in the DNA or the genes. They're all similar terms. But they represent the blueprints that tell a cell in an organism what shape it's going to be, what character it's going to have, how it's going to operate. And modern biotechnology and genetics now has the tools to actually to read the DNA molecules that are in all our cells, to read the actual instructions, read the sentence that describe how the machine is going to work and be built. Many of your listeners will have seen articles in the newspaper about the Human Genome Project or the Mouse Genome Project or the Corn Genome Project. And these represent primarily federally funded, taxpayer-funded efforts to extract this information from the molecules inside our cells. Now, in addition to the ability to read the book, geneticists and molecular biologists have the tools to cut up the DNA molecules, to cut up the genes, and splice them from one cell into another. Now that's a revolutionary change. I mean, all through human history, corn has given rise to corn and oak trees to oak trees and bacteria to bacteria. And now the technology exists so that you can cut out the blueprints that tell a corn plant how to grow and develop and splice those into bacteria. A dramatic example would be, for example, the production of insulin. There are millions of people in the United States who are given insulin to alleviate the problems with diabetes. And this used to be obtained from slaughterhouses. You'd cut up the pancreas from cows or pigs, and there's a little region that synthesizes this protein called insulin, and then this would be purified and packaged and distributed to people. Nowadays, there's a factory plant in Indianapolis, Indiana, Eli Lilly. And there are giant vats, as similar to used for the production of beer, the size of silos, that are full of bacteria. And these bacteria have the human gene, your gene, my gene, the human blueprint for insulin, spliced into the bacteria. So these bacteria are producing human insulin, and this provides almost the entire U.S. need for insulin in the United States. Now that's a two-edged sword. On the one hand, insulin can enormous amounts of insulin can be produced at extremely low cost. So there's no longer any shortage of insulin in the United States. Everybody ought to be able to have access to insulin, and most do. On the other hand, the changes in technology has resulted in a kind of corporate exploitation of this technology, and it's now possible to patent genes, human genes. So Eli Lilly, for example, owns a patent on the human insulin gene, your gene, my gene. And as a result, a patent allows you to prevent anybody else from using the competition, using the information. So there's very limited competition for the production of human insulin because of the patent control. And so Lilly is able to charge quite a substantive, set the price for human insulin quite high. So on the one hand, we ought to be in a period of plenty. On the other hand, the privatization of the technology is resulting in increased cost of drugs. And that's one concrete example.
Dr. King, I mean, just in that opening statement you made, there are certainly so many questions that come to my mind. I mean, on the one hand, now we're talking about being able to really construct new life forms. I mean, correct?
Correct.
And so, I mean, that leads us into a whole realm of uncharted roads. And how do we develop some sort of ethical base whereby, I mean, as you stated regarding the issue with insulin, I mean, on the one hand, it's a tremendously beneficial thing. On the other hand, done simply to make money, people could be, you know, literally held hostage.
Right.
We're moving into a whole new world, a brave new world, to steal a phrase.
No, you're absolutely correct. And because one of the features of this is that the technology is moving enormous, very, very, very quickly, far faster. You know, even a person who's a professional in the field and is paid, you know, is spending 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day working in the area, finds it difficult to keep up. And I would say the social and political mechanisms that you need to direct this technology in a socially productive direction, they're just not in place. For example, the thing I mentioned about it's possible now to patent life forms. You know, people are astonished at that. They say, "Well, how could you do that? That they didn't invent. How could somebody patent a rice plant? They didn't invent it. They just, you know, exploited it and discovered it." And that change took place about 15 years ago, 18 years ago. And you might think that the Congress, that there was a public debate about whether a Monsanto corporation could own a whole strain of soybeans or corn or cotton. But no, there hasn't been any public debate. There's no public mechanism to control it. Many of your listeners have been reading about the debates over genetically engineered food. And this is a case where none of the legal apparatus that exists in the United States addresses something like that because it represents a new technology. But the bottom line is, one, the great majority of this research was paid for by the American people, and they ought to be able to direct and benefit from its outcome.
Caller, you're live on the air.
Yes, I had a question about the liability exposure of companies that create genetically engineered foods that, or viruses or whatever, that could become runaway and damage.
A very interesting question. Well, in general, there had been silence around that issue in the United States. Just recently, Novartis, I think it was Novartis, which was one of the big biotech companies, had been marketing baby food in which some of the nutrients in the baby food came from genetically modified plants. And this was brought to public attention, or Novartis pulled the genetically modified foodstuffs out of the baby food. And personally, I think it was a response to the fact that a European firm or legal group raised this question of liability and said, well, you know, if these things have unexpected health consequences or somehow cause social damage, there's the possibility that the firms behind that are pushing the technology are going to be liable for it. Now, with human... By the way, one thing here, it's going to be a little funny. This technology applies to corn, and it applies to humans, right? The discussion is usually compartmentalized. You're either worried about genetically modified corn, or you're worried about human genetic engineering.
Right.
Same technology. Now, your question has come up. This morning's news carried a report from the National Bioethics Commission about the use of something called stem cells. Stem cells are derived from embryos that don't develop into embryos, and is closely connected to the question of human genetic engineering. And the President's Bioethics Commission, in considering whether we should allow human genetic manipulation, one of the questions they raised, well, who is liable for such a child if errors are made, if the technology doesn't work as simply as one has thought it was going to, if the genes are doing more things than the scientists think they are, and the child, you know, develops in who knows what manner. And there's no mechanism right now to deal with questions of social responsibility and liability in that area. The Council for Responsible Genetics, our position is one, slow down. Certainly, we should not be proceeding with human genetic engineering, human genetic modification, until there's been much, much, much broader social debate, much deeper putting in place of, you know, mechanisms of liability, control, oversight. You know, what's the rush? Now, the rush is that there's a lot of money to be made off this, and that's what's driving it.
We're talking with Dr. Jonathan King, professor of molecular biology at MIT and also member of the board of directors of the Council for Responsible Genetics. I mean, as I understand it, and I know I sometimes get the names confused between the Human Genome Project, and I know there's another one, and I just can't remember it right now. But, I mean, there actually is a move to collect human genetic material,
Yes. Classify
it, and then perhaps in some cases efforts being made by private corporations to say, we own that. I mean,
you're absolutely right. In fact, in your part of the country, one of the related program that you're thinking of is called the Human Genome Diversity Project.
Right.
And their plan was to collect tissue, cells and tissues from indigenous peoples, for example, Native Americans, the Indians of Papua New Guinea, these populations around the world, in order to examine the genetic relationships between these different groups of people. And the Native Americans, who've actually formed an indigenous peoples network to resist this, have said, wait a minute, this is our body, our substance, our tissue. We don't view this as somebody's property, as corporate property, and we're very concerned about what's going to be done with this information. Now, that project is not directly the project of corporations, but waiting in the wings are a whole variety of companies who are planning to exploit that information and have actually filed for patents on human cell lines. Human tissues, which are being actively contested by a number of these groups.
In part, point being that perhaps certain genetic strains of the human species seem to be more resistant or more prone
right.
to certain characteristics,
right.
and if companies were to own this genetic structure,
right.
they could then use that to
That's right.
create
That's
whatever, right?
That's right. Why don't I make it more concrete for your listeners
by
giving an example of something that's actually going on. Millions of Americans, particularly millions of American women, are concerned about cancer. They're concerned about breast cancer. And one of the key steps in getting cancer is that the genes of those tissues get damaged. Right? You get lung cancer, you smoke a cigarette, in the smoker, carcinogens are chemicals that damage DNA, they damage the genes, in this case in your lung cells, and the cells start dividing out of control, and that's what causes a tumor. So when you get breast cancer, that's because certain genes in your breast tissue have been damaged by generally unknown agents when it comes to breast cancer, not when it comes to lung cancer. We know what's doing the damage then. Well, there's a company out there in Salt Lake City, Myriad Genetics, and they've obtained a patent on some of the damaged genes in human breast cancer. What they're doing with this patent, so they own that information, and if you send them a sample of tissue, they'll analyze it for $2,400 or something, and they'll send you back the information. That's stage one. Stage two, well, what do you do if you find that you have damaged genes? You can see coming down the pike, well, we'll sell you, using genetic engineering technology, the normal gene, right? We'll try to, by technology not yet developed but very actively being pursued, we'll replace in some of your breast cells the damaged gene with the normal gene. You'll have to pay through the nose for that. Now, a very different direction that could be taken with this technology would be to say, well, we know what kind of damage leads to breast cancer. Why don't we go out there in the environment or in the floor wax or in the your automobile exhaust, and ask, where are the carcinogens or the radiation that's damaging our breast genes? And let's remove them from the environment and prevent cancer rather than sell somebody, therapy. Well, you can't make any money preventing cancer, right? The money is made by letting the person get sick and then selling them a very expensive technology. Here again, you have this Jekyll and Hyde thing where the scientific advances give promise to, you know, eliminating and alleviating some horrendous diseases, but the privatization of the technology is taking it in a very different direction to generate a product that you can sell. And this is happening, all through our society. That's what's going on with Monsanto and Roundup Ready soybeans. Those soybeans don't make any better pancakes than normal soybeans, but they can be sold to farmers on a much more advantageous basis.
This is Full Logic Reverse. We'll be back in just a few moments. We're talking with Dr. Jonathan King, professor of molecular biology at MIT and also member of the board of directors of the Council for Responsible Genetics.
www.genewatch with a dash between gene and watch.org.
That was,
you can sign our No Patents on Life petition online.
That was really good. I mean, you just jumped right in there with that. One of the things that never ceases to amaze me is that the vast majority of the research that has set the stage for this type of genetic dissection and engineering and gene mixing and all of that stuff was done at public expense, correct?
That's right.
But the results of that, and once that technology is developed to a point where it can become profitable, somehow or another it finds itself in the private hands.
That's right. Now, that was not always the case. You know, most of this research is financed by the National Institutes of Health. That's an agency of the federal government that distributes your tax dollars to universities and medical researchers around the United States. It's a wonderful aspect of post-World War II U.S. history, in a sense of kind of public advance of critical knowledge. And a lot of us are healthier, and a lot of us recover from diseases that we didn't used to recover from because of this federal funding. However, some very specific changes were made starting in the 80s. One of them was led by certain groupings in Congress who had corporate interests closer to their heart than public interest, to change the rules to support the privatization. So it used to be, now I do, you know, this biomedical research. It's partially what I do for a living in a sense. Your tax dollars pay for my research, and I give back into the public sector useful knowledge about proteins in my case. It used to be that if a federally funded scientist made a true invention, something that was legitimate to patent under the old patent laws, that would revert back to the federal government. It would be in the public domain because the research had been financed by the federal government, by taxpayers. And this was changed in the 80s in something called the Bayh-Dole Act, which explicitly said, well, no, the government, public, won't own this technology. It'll be owned by the universities or the companies in which it was done. And the laws have continually been massaged to make it easier and easier and easier for a private corporation who had nothing to do with the development of the technology, except they're putting the cherry on the banana split, to end up basically owning the technology. And the patent, changing the patent law is one of the primary ways, because the patent law, you didn't have to necessarily make the discovery. The patent goes to the first person to file the patent application. So you can have an enormous body of research, and then the last little bit is done in company laboratories, and then they file for the patent, and then they control the knowledge and the use of it for the next 20 years.
Caller, you're live on the air.
Here you have Democrats and Republicans that are selling us out. They don't care about us at all. They're totally the lowest scum of the earth, and they're just, you know, selling us out to these corporate pigs. And I can't understand why people are so stupid to keep voting for Democrats or Republicans. I mean, you got to vote independent. You got to vote for somebody
right.
who gives.
But you know, they're not stupid. They stayed home in droves, right? In the last election, fewer Americans voted than in any other previous election, right? Less than 50% of the registered voters, less than a third of the adults. So I believe that there's much more support for the position that you're putting forward, and just the emergence of these independent and third parties is very, very slow. I'm associated with a newly formed Labor Party, and, you know, I tell you, it's a tough harder road to get people to recognize that, yeah, you can have some other party. You don't have to be limited to Democrats and Republicans. But I think you're naming, you know, that's where the future lies, is a significant fraction of the American people wanting to have their own voice.
Well, I guess the only thing that's going to make these people snap out of it and quit being so stupid as far as not going out and voting for the people that care about them is perhaps some major tragedy. You know, one of these genetically engineered things is going to get loose and start killing off thousands of people. People are just too complacent. I think they're just too stupid. You got to get out there and vote and do something about it.
I would agree with your statement that people are too complacent. I don't think people are too stupid, but
people are smart.
Yeah,
right?
I would agree with that too. Thank you for calling
in. Vote for in their local election, that their choice is limited, and so they're discouraged.
Let me take this opportunity to perhaps do a little bit of promo for next week's show. We're scheduled to have with us Dr. Lenora Falani, and she's going to be talking about a unified independent party. So we'll be talking with Dr. Falani about that next week, and perhaps we can address the caller's issues then. Dr. King, I just wanted to ask you, because, you know, we've talked about a lot of issues regarding genetics and ethical considerations. Have you seen the movie Gattaca?
Yes, In fact, the MIT Student Association showed it and asked me to be one of the commentators on it.
Talk a little bit about
chilling.
It. Do you see that as being a real possibility?
Well, there is plenty of technology in the works to move in exactly that direction. I don't know how many of your listeners saw Gattaca, but in Gattaca, everybody is identified according to their genome, and everywhere you go, you know, you stick your thumb down, and it checks that you have the DNA that you're supposed to have, and then they have your life spun out. Gattaca is absolutely accurate in the sense that all the technology they showed existed. What is misrepresented is the notion that humans are the products of the genes. Humans are not products of the genes. Humans are the products of human culture. And what differentiates humans from all other species on the surface of the earth is we have language, we have brains, we have culture. And what the brain is a device that uncouples your behavior from your genes. So my mother tells me there's mercury in the tuna fish. I stopped eating that tuna fish without any change in my genes.
Right.
Not like a spider that has to go through hundreds of generations or to change their food preferences. So humans have evolved this other mechanism, language, culture, that allows for the transmission of information not through genes, but through a different mechanism. It wasn't in my genes that I played tight end in high school. The coach taught me how to play tight end, right? And other people play basketball, and other people play polo, and none of that is in their genes. Gattaca treats humans as the product of their genes. There are many groups in American society who would like to promote that notion that, for example, you know, how much you're going to learn or what your job is going to be is in your genes. That is not true. A great deal of this variation that's presented as controlling your behavior and destiny, that is scientifically false, right? That's being promoted, you know. Why'd you drop out of high school? Because it was in your genes. There's nothing we can do about it.
And point being in Gattaca, though, that when this type of research was misapplied and applied in the way it was applied in the movie, that your entire future, or lack
right.
of same, was decided
right.
immediately right. based on the fact that right. you may have a 1 in 10,000th chance of developing some sort of illness, so
right.
therefore nobody
right.
was going to invest
right.
in educating
right.
you or
right.
training
right.
you for
right.
a job or
right.
whatever.
Right. Right. And you're going to see things like that. You're going to see headlines that say, you know, scientists identify gene for depression. Scientists identify gene for poor mathematical or high mathematical ability, and, you know, therefore, if you don't have that, you know, give it up. But that is false. right? That's propaganda and not science. Gattaca shows that future, but that aspect of it, you know, hopefully we will resist and overcome.
Hopefully. We're talking with Dr. Jonathan King, professor of molecular biology at MIT, also member of the board of directors of the Council for Responsible Genetics.
And the views I'm representing are my own in the councils and not MIT's.
Okay. Well, I have to do a disclaimer at the end of this show every week, so I feel good that someone else has to join me in doing that. People want to always make it clear that when the views spoken on this program are those of the people who spoke them. But I'll do that later. Dr. King, we just have a couple of minutes left.
I'd just like to mention to your listeners that in other parts of the world, in Europe, in India, there are very strong social movements resisting this privatization of genetic information, out of control biotechnology. In the United States, it's been very slow to develop, but it is developing, and it's going to be possible for people to express their views, work together with other people. The end of November, there's going to be this World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle, in which the world's corporate powers are going to further carve up the world's gene. Well, one of the issues is control of animals and plants, and thousands of people are planning to go to Seattle, you know, basically in opposition to what the World Trade Organization is proposing in terms of plants and animals and their genes.
Well, I guess I'll take this opportunity to do a further promotion, and we will be going to cover the World Trade Organization meeting and what's going on.
I'll be there too.
Oh, cool.
I'll meet you.
Sounds like a good idea. I've got a hotel room. I'm told that it is actually 6 blocks from the hub of evil itself, is what I was told. So, yes, we'll see each other up there as well. We've been speaking with Dr. Jonathan King, professor of molecular biology at MIT, and also member of the board of directors of the Council for Responsible Genetics. Dr. King, a final thought for our audience?
Humans... all our genes have evolved over hundreds and millions of years. We're all part of one species. We're all part of one planet, and we ought to be using this extraordinary knowledge of how things work to make sure that all of us can participate in a better life in the future. And it's going to come, and radio programs like yours are one small spark in the desert.
Well, thank you. Dr. Jonathan King, thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. It's been my pleasure to be part of the team bringing you this edition of the program today. If you'd like more information about Full Logic Reverse, you can contact us via email, FLR@JPS.net, or by phone 530-265-9462. We invite you to join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.